and welcome to the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. I'm David Grigg, and as always, I'm joined by my valued co-host, Perry Middlemiss. But you haven't been feeling your best, have you, Perry?
Hello, David. No, I've come down with the dreaded COVID. Picked it up last Sunday, and I have 2 days left in isolation, so I will be looking forward greatly to getting out of isolation. It's actually harder to do this than it is in the lockdowns, because at least in the lockdowns you're allowed to get out and do a bit of exercise, and one person a day could go down the street to actually buy something in the shops. All three of us in the house came down with COVID last week, and none of us have been out of the house since Sunday. Mm. So I did go and take the bins out and bring them back in, but other than that, I haven't been outside the front door or the front gate. I'm starting to get a bit sick. Yeah, well, I'm just starting to get a bit sick of it, but I'm feeling a heck of a lot better than I was 4 or 5 days ago. It's now just feeling like the tail end of a bad cold, and I'll be fine by, well, as fine as I ever could be, David, which for a lot of people's perspective is not really very good at all, but I should be fine. So I'll get there. So I'm, so I'll be happy to see the end of this, to be perfectly frank, but in some ways, it actually gives me a little bit of extra COVID protection, because I don't really have to worry about anything for the next 3 months, because I can't get any more boosters, not allowed to, for 3 months. And they generally say that at least for 6 weeks you've got a much higher level of immunity. So,
well, let's hope that's true.
But I don't recommend it to anybody. Try not to get it. I keep trying
not to get it, but it's a matter of time, I'm sure.
Oh, well, it possibly is, but none of us can work out where the heck we got this from. So we just don't know. So no. Could have been me, could have been the wife, could have been my son, could have been any of us that got it and brought it to the house, and off she goes. And so, you know, 2.5 years in, finally get it.
There we go.
Yeah, so that's all right. Yeah, it's what happens.
Never mind. All right, shall we roll on to some news?
We should roll on to some news. There is a little bit in the genre. Genres, because we do like to look at crime and mystery as well.
Sure.
And I've got a bit of information about some of that.
Yeah.
The major science fiction and fantasy news since our last podcast is that the 2022 Nebula Awards have been announced. These are the awards that are given out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and are probably, well, from a fantasy reader's perspective, they're probably number two. From a writer's perspective, they're probably number one. So there's the Hugo Awards, which we'll be talking about later, and the Nebulas, and probably number three is the Locus Awards. So they are still coming up later in June, and we'll probably have the winners of those in the next podcast.
Mm.
But anyway, just for the high points, just to give you the fiction ones for the Nebula Awards, best novel was won by A Master of Gin by P. Dejelly Clark, which is also a finalist for the 2022 Hugo Award. Best Novella, And What Can We Offer You Tonight by Primi Mohammed, not a finalist for the 2020 Hugos. That's interesting. But we will talk about that on another episode. Best Novelette, O2 Arena by, and forgive me, I checked this out this morning, so hopefully I have got the pronunciation right. Can't even pronounce pronunciation, but hopefully I can get this gentleman's name right. Oganek Ovi, Donald Ek Pecky.
Well done.
Who's a finalist for the 2022 Hugo Award. And the best short story, Where Oaken Hearts Do Gather by Sarah Pinsker, also a finalist for the 2022 Hugo Award. And we will be talking about the novelettes and short stories later in this podcast. So stay tuned for those. On the crime fiction or thriller front, the 2022 International Thriller Awards, which are given out by the International Thriller Writers Group, have been announced, and the best hardcover novel was run by Razorblade Tears by S.A. Cosby, who I talked about earlier on. Now, this is two in a row for this particular author, because he won with Blacktop Wasteland in 2021. So, David, if you like a little bit of southern noir thriller action stuff, I think you might have to start reading this tournament.
Might be the person to look for. Yeah.
I think you should, because two in a row, it's pretty damn good.
Yeah.
And I thought Razorblade Tears was better than Blacktop Wasteland. Still needs to come up a couple of steps to be sort of like really top of his form. But you can see the progression of him moving his way forward. So start with Blacktop Wasteland and then go to Razorblade Tears. Two great titles, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
And both of which have been optioned for film versions coming up. So that will be very interesting. And, of course, he is an African-American writer and he has African-American main characters, which, again, is going to be rather interesting.
Mm.
And you cannot write the... You cannot adapt these books by changing the main character into a Caucasian. It just will not work.
Gosh,
it will not work. And the best paperback original for the International Thriller Awards is Bloodline by Jess Lowry. Don't know that writer at all, but, oh well, I'll have to try and check it out. Yep, just don't know. And one last thing, Australian Book Awards, because this is a little bit apropos of this particular episode. The Australian Book Design Awards were announced about a week or so back. And the best design non-fiction cover, there were joint winners, and one of them was He, written by Murray Bale, published by Text and designed by W.H. Chong.
Oh, well done.
Our friend of the podcast and who is going to be coming up later on in this particular episode. He won that, as he was a joint winner for that, with Sex Lies and Question Time. Kate Ellis, who's an ex-federal politician, that was from Hardy Grant and was designed by Ella Egerty. So I sent a note through to Chong and congratulated him, and he was very chuffed about having won that, as you can imagine.
Indeed.
So he's won a few of these awards in the past, but one of the judges said he thought it was one of the most elegant book covers that he had ever seen.
Hmm.
It's quite simple but elegant, and it does exactly what it needs to do. And so Chong did very well with that. So
indeed.
That's it.
Indeed.
Well, that's my news at this stage. I don't have anything else. So,
I don't have anything else, right?
Yeah, no. I think that's enough.
Yep.
All right, so let's move on to the major part of this particular episode. And we're going to be talking about the short fiction categories for the 2022 Hugo Awards, namely the short story and novelette.
Yeah.
And as people will remember, the short story awards run up to 7,500 words. But there's one thing I wanted to jump in with first, just before we get started, because you have experience of this. Well, so do I, but you have it slightly differently. In that the Hugo Award packet is now available from ShyCon 8, which is this year's WorldCon. And I believe that you have signed up for it, David. Would you like to give us a run-through about how you went about doing that?
How I went about doing it? Well, the reason I did it was because we've been looking at all these nominees for the Hugos this year, I started to get to the point where I thought, oh, darn it, I really want to vote for these things. so it was pretty easy to do. You go to the ShyCon website and sign up. You need to be a supporting member. I think it was $50 US.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but that's a darn good bargain, really, because as part of that, you get this Hugo voting package, and it's got the entirety of all of the novels that have been nominated and as ebooks, but you can read all your way through all the novels in that way for free as part of that thing. You get all the novellas, you get all of the short stories and novelettes as well. Although the latter two, I think, are all available online anyway. But nevertheless, certainly you get for free the novellas and the novels, which I think is a very good bargain. And you get to be a participant in the convention, which is a good thing too. And you get to vote, of course. And I believe you also get the chance to nominate next year's awards. Is that right? I think if you're a member of this one.
I believe that's true.
You can nominate.
You do get to nominate.
And there's at least one book I've got already on my mind that I will nominate for best novel for next year.
Oh, all right. Also, I believe you get the Lodestar Awards. The story's coming out of that. That's for the young adult. That's the young adult Award, which isn't a Hugo, but which is run by the Hugo Awards Committee and presented at the Hugo Awards ceremony, similarly for the Astounding Award for Best New Writer. Mm. So that's interesting. So yeah, as you say, though, so 50 US, what's that?
About
75,
about
80?
70, I think it ended up.
Yeah, 75, 80. Yeah.
Not even that much.
Well, okay, 75 Australian, and and for that you get 6 novels, 6 novellas, six or seven short stories, 6 or 7, whatever. So you get a big swag of
stuff. Yeah, yeah.
You get a big swag of fiction all there together, and it's, well, as you will find out as we discuss it over the next coming episodes, you'll find out whether some of it's any good or not in terms of whether we think it's any good or not.
Mm.
But I think it's for value for money, I think it's probably the best way you can do it. Mm. And once you become a supporting member, if you do that, then that allows you to vote for the site selection for the Worldcon in 2024. And once you've voted for that, you then automatically become a supporting member of that convention. So once you get into the role, all you need to do then is to pay for your voting fee, which is about the same, about $50 US. Don't quote me on that because it can change and it is allowed to change, but it's somewhere in that vicinity. And once you get into that habit of voting for the site selection, you automatically become a supporting member of whichever site happens to win in 2024 and 25 and so on and so forth, and you pick up the packet, you pick up everything that you need to get each time as you carry on. And so that is the easiest and best way of doing it. And just keep on rolling and off you go. Yep.
There you go. All right, excellent. Yes, no, I decided to do it and I'm happy that I did, so that's good.
All right, okay, so let's talk about the Hugo Short Story finalists. We'll work these up one at a time, alternating. We've split them up into so three each, and so we can basically work our way through them, which seems like a good way to go. So, David, you're going to kick us off. So what's your first one?
Okay, mine's called Unknown Number by Blue Neustifer. I'm not sure how you pronounce that, Blue Neustifer. And the interesting thing about this one is it was presented on Twitter, not as a series of tweets on Twitter, but as a series of images which purport to be screenshots from a mobile phone conversation in a series of texts between two people. Now, that's interesting as a way of presenting a story, but personally I don't see how it's very different from it would be presenting the same conversation as though it were a phone conversation or even a face-to-face conversation. So surely the interest here can't be all about the unusual format. So I'm not sure why that's considered to be something of interest in itself. So beyond that, with this little conversation that's going backwards and forwards, it's a sort of touching story about someone from another timeline seeking out themselves, their doppelganger in this timeline, to see if they change their gender. And because the person that's doing the contacting is uncertain about whether they should go ahead and make that change, they're suffering from gender dysphoria. So they get this conversation goes backwards and forwards, and they get some pretty useful life advice in return from the person in this timeline who has transitioned to a different gender. In some ways, that whole thing reminds me a little of Bob Shaw's novel, The Two-Timers, if you recall it, which has got a similar theme of someone switching timelines to try to correct a mistake they made in their own timeline and coming in contact with their own self in that other timeline. So I put it down as okay, but not outstanding. Certainly, I don't personally think it would be of the caliber that a Hugo winner should have, but there you go. What did you think of it, Perry?
Yeah, I'd have a tendency to agree. I didn't find a huge amount of interest here beyond the initial way that it was presented. It's really an attempt at a modern form of epistolary story of letters going backwards and forwards, and these ways are SMS messages going back. So from that perspective, it's interesting. It's the first ever short story, I believe, that's been originally published on Twitter. So that may have been why it garnered a bit of enthusiasm. But frankly, I think it's interesting, but that's about it. I just don't think it goes anywhere.
No, not really.
Yeah, I actually gave this one the lowest of the lot for me. So I just didn't find a huge amount of interest in this one.
All right,
mine, Proof by Induction by Jose Pablo Iriat. This short story is also it's a finalist for the Locus Awards and was a finalist for the 2022 Nebula Awards for this year. So Paula Gifford is a mathematician whose father has just died. Paula Gifford is the lead character in this particular story. And prior to his father's death, the two of them have been working on a proof of the Perelman hypothesis, which is a mathematical theorem that has proved impossible to solve to date. In this story, the consciousness of of those who have just died are loaded in sort of a snapshot form into a database called a coda. It's possible for those living to enter this coda in a sort of virtual form and converse with the dead, although the dead person can't learn anything new or remember anything past the time of their death. So they're okay up until the time of their death, but nothing, of course, beyond that, because this is where the information and the data ends. Now, can't even remember, the person that's died in this coda can't even remember if the person visiting has ever visited before, because that, of course, happened after the person died. So Paula keeps going backwards and forwards talking to his father because he's got this problem that he's trying to solve. And he's attempting to gain tenure at his university and decides to try to continue his collaboration with his father on this particular problem via the use of this coda. So, look, it's all fairly predictable. And the basic idea is a good one that might have been used better, I think, at a greater length. And also on something else, because I don't really feel as though that I got to a sense that they had achieved anything. I mean, I like the idea of him being able to go back and talk to his father and discuss a problem. But, of course, every time he discusses a problem, he's got to start right back from square one and work his way all the way right through up to where they were before and then carry on with what was going on before, because his father can't remember any of the questions. If he can get him to the point where his father, where he can start him in the middle of some place, well, you know what happens if you get to this point? Yeah, okay, then off they go. Then that's all right. But mostly he's just got to restart all the way right back from the beginning. And so nice idea, wasn't really taken anywhere that I thought that it could have gone.
Mm.
David?
Mm. Yeah, no, I didn't quite see what the point of the story was. what's the point the author's trying to make? You know, love is more important than mathematics? I don't know. I felt rather let down when I got to the end of it. So, yeah, I wasn't too impressed by that. All right, so what have I got next? I've got, this one, The Sin of America. Mm. I really, 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 really didn't like this. Let me see. Okay. In a way, it's funny, really, because it's quite well written. And it starts off fairly well. But it ends up being seriously weird and creepy, I think. So, yeah, I wasn't very keen on it. Let's see. What can we say about it? Well, I guess the core of the story is an ancient concept. It's the idea that one individual in a society can be chosen, either at random or specially targeted, to atone for the sins of that society. Now, you can see this idea coming up in many primitive societies. It's kind of the idea of a king for the day who is then sacrificed to ensure the next harvest will come through. It's the basis of Shirley Jackson's famous short story, The Lottery. And, of course, it's the fundamental idea behind the crucifixion of Jesus, chosen to be the sacrificial Lamb of God who taketh away the sins of the world. But here the presentation is much more banal. The protagonist, who's called Ruby Rose Martineau, is eating the sin of America. Literally, somehow eating it in the form of a huge meal that she's forced to consume in a local diner in the town of Sheridan. And at the end, she staggers out bloated with this meal and then meets the kind of sticky end you'd expect from knowing all these other tellings of the story. And everybody else lives happily ever after. I don't know what else to say about it. I didn't like it. So there you go.
No, I'm in agreement with you. This is it's based on the myth of this or the custom of the sin eater.
Yeah.
Which is occurs a lot in Europe and, medieval Europe, where the idea was that, as you say, a certain person in town is nominated as the sin eater, and they come in during the wake when the body is laid out and eat food off the corpse or around the corpse, with the idea being that they will eat as much as they possibly can to consume the sin of the deceased person, to allow that person then to be able to go to heaven. Now, what happens to the sin eater, I'm not terribly sure. And that would be the interesting thing, or if it had been carried on to go that way. I mean, you almost get the point with some of these short stories that they're like a slice out of a larger work. Mm. There's got to be more here, because frankly, there's not very much in this story at all.
No.
I mean, really, there's the background and the characters, it doesn't go anywhere.
No.
It just doesn't do anything. So that's what leads me to believe that this is a setup for something else coming up later on. Yeah, I don't think
I want to read the rest of it.
No, well, that's the problem, you see. If you get this point where you're only getting a slice of it and it's not really all that flash, you sort of start thinking, do I want to read the next bit? Not terribly sure. Now, Valente's had a very good year this year because she's got a story here in the short story category. She's got one, a novelette. She's got a novella as well. So she's got three nominations this year. This one, no. I wasn't overly keen on this one at all. So let's move to my next one, which is Mr. Death by Alex E. Harrow. And thank God we've got a story which I really quite liked. You can have your say later, David, but I like this one. This is a finalist for the 2022 Nebula and Locus Awards as well. Now, the main character of this is Sam Grayson, who is a junior reaper in the Department of Death. Who doesn't like a bit of death every now and again, David? And has, so far, successfully transported 221 souls across the River of Death. But number 222 is going to be his hardest yet. Lawrence Harper is scheduled to die of a cardiac arrest at the age of 30 months, so he's a young child, and Sam is having some difficulty in facilitating his transition. It's the classic idea, death stands there, waits, the person dies, right, okay, and then pulls them across. So Sam's having so much difficulty, he just can't do it at all. It just doesn't do it. So Lawrence reminds him too much of his own son and his son's untimely death for him to be able to complete his task properly. And that doesn't go down terribly well at all with his managers in the department, as you can imagine. But I won't give the game away because it moves in a different direction. And I thought this was a light moving story and I thought it was handled well. You look at it from the perspective of a bit of humanity in death. Yeah, that's okay. I don't mind that. So I enjoyed this one. I was happy to read this one, and Alex E. Harrow has also got a novella on this year's finalist list, and that's also a good story. I do think she is an author to follow, and I like this. David?
Yeah, I quite liked it too. It's a fairly lightweight sort of story, I thought, and but yeah, it's okay. The idea of a death's assistant or apprentice not wanting to let the victim die reminded me a lot of Terry Pratchett's novel Mort, in which indeed death takes an apprentice, but that has a satirical trend to it, which isn't here in this story. But yeah, it was a kind of touching sort of story, but it sort of ended a bit wimpy, I thought, but that was okay. It was okay.
Yep.
All right, so what have I got next? I've got Tangles by Shauna Maguire. What can we say? I didn't think this was a very interesting bit of fantasy. So we start off with a character called Wren, W-R-E-N-N, who has a companion she simply calls Six, which we don't quite understand who that companion is at the beginning. But it turns out that Six is a walking tree and that Wren is a dryad who is able to dwell in and control certain trees with which she has some kind of magical resonance. And with them, she travels between the worlds of different universes, timelines, whatever, something like that. But at this point where the story happens, Six is now weary or used up, and she leaves it behind on a new world, Innistrad, to look for another tree that she can live in and walk around in. So then we cut to another point of view character, Teferi, who is a wizard, and is here on Innistrad to help the locals track down a dangerous witch who is reportedly loose in the forest. Turns out, of course, that this witch is Wren, the dryad. So Teferi and Wren meet up, make friends, and they're attacked by some kind of monster out of the blue. Now, Teferi defeats the monster with a magical spell, but he messes it up, and then he and Wren have to deal with a kind of maze of paths that he's created in the forest. So they can't find their way out of this tangle in the forest, tangle of paths in the forest. And all the while, Wren is getting weaker and weaker because she hasn't found her special tree. Now, in the end, it turns out that Teferi has inadvertently created a way for Wren to find her special tree. She climbs into the tree, which thus becomes Seven, and everyone lives happily ever after. Ho-hum. Wasn't impressed.
Fairly average, wasn't it?
Yeah, very average.
I gather it's a story set within the Magic the Gathering fantasy world, so card game.
Is it?
Yeah, so I'd know nothing about that particular area, but I just happened to find, doing a bit of research on this particular story, I gather that's the background. Doesn't really have a lot to say. Not, I mean, you know, it's a reasonable enough story, and it might well be fantastic if that's fits into that particular game world that people inhabit and enjoy. Maybe it was fantastic for that.
No,
and, you know,
maybe
that's all right. No, I don't really think so.
Not for me.
No, not at all. Well, my last one and the sixth one, which I think is actually the best of the whole bunch, is Where Oaken Hearts Do Gather by Sarah Pinsker. This actually won the 2022 Nebula Award for Best Short Story, as I mentioned. It's also up for the Locus Award as well. Now, this particular story, similar to the first one that you talked about, David, that was done with sort of SMS messages, this story is told as a series of posts on a bulletin board discussing an ancient British folk ballad called Where Oaken Hearts Do Gather. And the various verses of this ballad are picked apart by the contributors looking for the hidden meaning behind the song, and also dealing with all the variations and what was the different verses and so on. And so that conversation's all rather interesting, and you think, oh, well, it's just going to be fairly boring. But one of them starts posting that they've travelled to the same English village where the ballad is reported to have originated and is investigating the village's history to try and find a historical event that might explain the ballad's true origins. But his posts are rather a bit mysterious. They sort of say one thing, but you're not terribly sure exactly what. And they seem to be full of a sort of a sense of foreboding about what's going to be coming up. Now, these are not necessarily all in strict chronological order, that you sometimes get some posts back on, as you would in a bulletin board. Somebody says something, you write about it, and then you notice that, oh, there's somebody else has commented on a post that was there from 2 days before, and you read that particular post back there. So you start getting hints about, who's this guy and why is he talking about this? And then later on, you slowly start getting a bit more information about what he's doing and where he's travelling to. So it takes a bit of work for the reader to be able to work it out. And if you miss the little clues that are floating around in it, you would probably think this was a terribly boring, boring story completely. But I thought it was really, really interesting. It's a very innovative approach in terms of how to do this. It took the authors had to use a lot of skill in order to get things just in the right order and just the right way, just to give you a little bit of a hint, a little bit more of a hint, a little bit more of a hint, but allow the story to work its way out until it gets down to the end. I really like this particular story because it it stuck with me. It's made me think, and I've read it a second time, and I'm fairly certain in the next month or so I'm going to go back and read this again. And I think that any short story that drags you back to it, because I'll keep on thinking, oh, maybe there's something else that I needed to go back and have a bit of a look at and sort of get a bit of an idea of. This was a good one, and I would really hardly recommend this. This is my pick of the year, and I'll be voting for it in the Hugos. David, what about you?
Yeah, I certainly think it's the best of the bunch here. And, I quite liked it. And the structure, as you say, is actually here very clever, whereas with the earlier story, which is told as a series of SMS texts, it didn't really add much to it. But here it's actually quite clever because there's an interaction between the various people posting on this supposed site. And, you know, one person will post something and somebody else will say, I'm downgrading that. That's a stretch, that what you're saying. That's not a stretch. You know, this is backward and forward banter between these people talking about this old ballad. But behind all of that going on, she builds up this increasing suspicion that, in fact, really is something weird happening in this particular place. And right at the end, where the guy has travelled there, so his last post is he goes off with someone else that he's met in the place, and you start to think, I don't think that's going to end well.
Shouldn't have done that.
No, that's good. No, I certainly, out of the stories that we're talking about here, I certainly would pick that as the best.
Yep.
And that's what I would be voting for.
Okay. Yeah, well, I had this one where Oaken Hearts Do Gather by Sarah Pinsker is my best, and probably second best I had, Mr. Death by Alex E. Harrow.
Certainly. Yeah, I would probably say that too. Yeah.
Right. Okay. All right, so that's our short stories. Let's move on to the Hugo Novelette finalists for 2022. Now, these are stories in the range of 7,500 to about 15,000 words. So they're that sort of longer short story. Now, this is I've always found that the novelette is probably the most problematic length for stories. I find the best are either short, sharp and sweet, so snappy, get in, do it, short stories, or something that's just a little bit longer, but not right out to the novel length, so novella. I find the novelette this being the sort of, they've got to be done very well to be able to fit this particular length. We'll see how we go with this category this year. The first ones of these that I'm going to be talking about is Bots of the Lost Ark by Suzanne Palmer. This is a story that's also a finalist for the 2022 Locus Award. And it's the author's sequel to her 2018 Hugo-winning story, The Secret Life of Bots, one that I really enjoyed. Now, we're still on the same starship. It's now 70 years later after that previous story, and the human crew of the ship are all in stasis. The ship's not really terribly flash, and they've just allowing it to float to get through, well, carry on, travel on, heading back to wherever they need to get to. Well, I think it doesn't really matter where they're going, but I think they're heading towards Earth, but who cares? And so 70 years, the robots, or the bots, have been allowed to roam free by the ship. It's an artificial intelligence, because it's calling itself the ship. And these robots have somehow evolved over that period and have all got a little bit rogue, clumping together in what they refer to as GLOMs, which is a short term for conglomerates. So the conglomerates of robots all go together. And they all sort of stick together in a sort of a shape. And they actually believe they're actually the real humans of the crew. They think that the human crew, which is in stasis, is like a myth and they just don't exist at all. They are the real crew because they've decided that that's basically what they are. So the ship has the artificial intelligence ship has basically lost control. It's let things run until it becomes obvious that we'll need to get these bots under direct management again and back to their assigned tasks. Because, you see, the ship is approaching a jump point. So it's another sort of the idea that you go up to a sort of a wormhole and you go to a jump point and you go through and carry on to your next part of your destination. Standard trope inside science fiction, of course. So the ship's approaching this jump point, but this point is controlled by an alien race that does not allow for machine intelligence to be in charge of anything at all. And, of course, here we've got an artificial intelligence, which is the ship, and all these robots running around all over the place trying to make out that they are their actual crew. And the ship has decided that it really needs to get the crew, or at least one of the crew, up and going to be in say that it's in charge of the whole ship, because otherwise they're going to get blown up by this particular artificial intelligence. So the ship decides that the only thing to do is to go back to the hero of the very first story, The Secret Life of Bots, who's called Bot 9, which has been asleep this whole period as well. And it wants it to help the ship get control of all the bots and revive the crew again, so they can get through this jump point. So it's an amusing and engaging story, but it isn't quite up to standard of the previous story. It's a good read, but easily forgotten, I think. I don't think there's anything really major new. Really had a lot of interesting quirky little bits to it, and I thought it was most amusing and I really enjoyed it. I would suggest that if you're going to read this, it's probably best that you read The Secret Life of Bots first to get you an idea of the background, which is only quite short, so you can read that, and then come on to this one. This one just isn't up to that standard of the first one, unfortunately. David?
My notes just say amusing enough story, not very profound. But yeah, it was fun to read, but that's about all you can say about it.
Well, put it this way. It is a strictly science fiction story. There is no fantasy in this at all.
This is a
long-running space voyage on a ship that's running into problems because things are going funny with the artificial intelligence and the robots that are keeping the thing going.
Yeah.
From that perspective, straight science fiction. There's a whole lot of others that are fantasy in this category in the previous one, but that one was straight SF.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so mine, next one I'm going to talk about is That Story Isn't the Story by John Wiswell. I thought this wasn't a bad horror story, which had something of a point to it. So we meet the main character, Anton, at the point where he's filling a trash bag with his stuff and clothes and a few personal effects. He's about to leave the townhouse where he's been living with a number of other people for a long time. And it seems that he's trying to escape from the owner of the place, a Mr. Bird. And we quickly realise that Mr. Bird is some kind of vampire, though it doesn't seem that his bites turn others into vampires, just makes them subject to his will. And the bites that he makes on people fail to heal, and they bleed copiously when Mr. Bird is near and when he's angry. Anton is making it out the door, and he thinks he's going to escape just as Mr. Bird's car pulls up. But if it wasn't for Anton's friend Grigori, who's picking him up, Anton would have been drawn back inside by Mr. Bird and Mr. Bird's assistants. So the rest of the story is about Anton's struggle not to be drawn back into Mr. Bird's house of horrors, and how his example in escaping manages to encourage the others who are living there to try to do the same. Anton's struggles are not without pain either to him or his friend Grigori, and it takes a great deal of courage for him to resist the threats that Mr. Bird's acolytes make against Anton and his friends. I don't have much else to say about it than that. I thought it was pretty well written, and it tells an interesting story. What was your take on it, Perry?
Yes, I thought it was a powerful story, but it was rather let down by the trite ending.
Mm.
And I just thought that it just faded away. I sort of read this as a metaphor for the battle associated with people coming out, the coming out of anybody who's a LGBTIQ plus person.
Mm.
You know, the struggle that you have to get away from a controlling environment, which can be physically and psychologically damaging, and they achieve it. But then it just fades out a little bit, I think, and I just thought it was a bit unfortunate that it ended the way that it did.
Hmm.
Still, you have what you have, don't you?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
That's it. My next story is a story by Fran Wild called Unseelie Brothers Limited, which is also a finalist for the 2022 Locus Award. Now, this is a sort of fantasy wish fulfillment style coming of age story. Now, the main character here, Sarah Sebastian, is a fashion design student who was promised to create a gown for her cousin Ree for the Fete Noir charity ball, which is a major ball being held in New York each year. When news arrives of the reappearance in New York of the fantastical Unseelie Brothers dress shop, Ree's mother forces the two girls to drop their work on the graduation design project to track down the store, because this store just appears somewhere in New York in a different place each time. So it's sort of travelling through a fantastical process that we're not going to go into because we don't know what it is. So Sarah has heard stories of this establishment all of her life, as her mother and her aunt wore their mysterious gowns from this particular store on the night they both met their husbands. But now Sarah's mother is missing, and as she, Sarah, enters the store with her aunt and cousin, she starts seeing images of her mother on the walls, photos of her in various arrangements and in various gowns. And while she's there, she shows somebody a design that she's made, and they all think it's really fantastic. And she receives an offer of work as a dress designer. And this is an offer that may help her find a mother, but which may also have severe and lasting ramifications for her future. So as I said, this is a coming-of-age story in a fantasy world where women's evening wear is the power of magic, rather like a modern fairy tale. I thought it was amusing, but not really top drawer. I think that, I think most people would get something out of this, but you sort of come away from, I came away from it thinking, maybe this should be a little bit more. Maybe it's just me and fashion, David. I mean, I'm not really what you call a fashion plate. And there are certain, we've all got our certain prejudices. And I sort of think, well, a dress is a dress, isn't it? But maybe not. Especially not in this particular in this particular story. So, David, what did you think?
Oh, I quite liked it. I thought it was amusing. I liked the idea of these kind of enchanted seamstresses, these enchanted dresses which take over their wearers, sometimes to fatal effect. That was quite clever. But, yeah, it's more of an amusing piece than anything else, I would say. Yeah, that's
about all.
Yep. Yeah, that's about all you can say. All right, so the next one I'm going to talk about is L'Esprit de l'Escalier by Catherine M. Valente. Now, we'll get to the meaning of what that title means in a bit, but considering how much I disliked The Sin of America by the same author, I wasn't expecting to like this, but I was wrong. I like this a lot. I think it's very clever. It's a clever, if depressing, modernization of the Orpheus tale. In this version, Orpheus is Orpheus is a famous rock musician living with his wife Eurydice. I'm never sure how to pronounce that. I'm guessing that's correct. Eurydice.
Well, I always say Eurydice, but
Eurydice, you know, perhaps whatever. And Eurydice is in a bad way, however, because she's dead, but she's been brought back to live on Earth by Orpheus, who in this telling of the tale never looked back as they climbed up from the staircase from Hades. And it's this stairway, presumably, which is referenced by the title of the story, L'Esprit de l'Escalier, which in English means the spirit of the staircase, which is used figuratively by the French to describe that feeling of regret you have after thinking of the best comeback in an argument once you've left the scene. It's too late. Here it's a bit more literal, because the regret here is that Orpheus didn't look back at Eurydice as he does in the original myth. In that myth, his looking back means that she has to return back to the underworld. But in this telling, he didn't look back, and so she returns to Earth, mobile and aware, but not alive. So, though she's back in Orpheus's house, her state as a living corpse makes his life very difficult and her existence intolerable. Later in the story, she accuses him and points out that he never asked her whether she wanted to return to Earth from Hades.
Consent, David. Yes. Consent is always the thing.
Exactly. Like too many men dealing with women, he simply assumed that he knew what was best for her. So I thought that was very powerful, and has this dark sort of humour. There's some very funny little bits in it with, you know, when Eurydice's father Apollo turns up with all his mates and sit around drinking. And the character Sisyphus turns up and he's kind of rolling a little stone around his knuckles. You know, it's got a couple of little jokes. But I basically thought that the points that that she makes about her treatment by Orpheus and the breaking of the myth dig very deeply. I thought that was good. So if I were voting, it would be a toss-up between this one and one of the other stories, which I'll discuss shortly. What did you think? You obviously didn't think so much of it?
No, I didn't think quite so much about this. I mean, I can see I've probably rated it a little bit lower than it should have been because there's some interesting story ideas floating around, but it really doesn't go anywhere in the end. It just sort of fades out. Now, to me, the original myth, the shock of the ending, you know, where basically Orpheus is taking Eurydice out of the underworld and he's told he's not allowed to look back until, well, is it he or they have crossed that invisible line? He thinks it's he, so when he gets over the line, he turns back and looks at her, but she hasn't crossed, and so then she's the one that goes and gets dragged back into hell again. Here, he doesn't look back, and they both get through and get out. But I thought, as I said, the shock of the original thing was the fact that he makes this big mistake about what he's heard, and he looks back and he's a bit like Lot, looking back at the, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah, and his wife, you know, turns into a pillar of salt.
Well, she looks back. In that story in the Bible, Lot's wife looks back and she gets turned into a pillar of salt. But yeah. I'm not sure you've quite got the story right about the original myth. Mm-hmm. I think he looks back because he's not certain that she's following.
Oh, okay.
And because that's the point that she makes to him here. You know, you assumed that I was following you. You know, you assumed, and you didn't look back. And in fact, there's a really clever little bit in it where she is actually walking up a staircase in the house, and she's just ahead of him on the staircase, and she looks back, and she says, "See, wasn't that hard, was it?" You know, I liked it a lot. I'd be very tempted to make this my first in this category. But anyway, we'll see. There's one other which may be there.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, I didn't rate it as highly as you, but this is what these discussions
matter
are about,
taste,
aren't they?
I mean, matter of taste,
it's a matter of taste, and I must admit, I did like the idea. I did like the idea that, well, she is dead, and when he brings her back, she's basically a zombie. She's one of the undead because she was dead.
Yeah.
She can't go from dead to being fully alive. And, you know, there's a lot of bits and pieces about how, you know, the jaw falls down and it looks like it's broken. They've got to push that back up again. And she's got this lovely grey pallor all about her. And I mean, there's some really nice touches there that don't delve too deeply in terms of the visceral horror, but you know that it's there and you start thinking, this wouldn't be very good, David.
No.
Sort of having one of the undead like that who's there who doesn't necessarily really want to be there.
That's right.
Anyway, there we go.
No, I thought it was good. Anyway.
All right, okay. So my next one is O2 Arena by Oganekovi, Donald Ekpeki. This won the Nebula Award for Best Novelette, and it's the finalist for the 2022 Locus Award as well. Now, this story is set in Nigeria in 2030, where the atmosphere is so polluted that oxygen credits are traded as currency because everybody needs to basically have some pure oxygen during the day, at least some part of the day. And so the air's polluted, the CO2 levels are fairly high, and everybody wears oxygen masks or masks to filter the air and also to breathe. Now, this story's narrator is currently studying law at a prestigious university, and he reconnects with an old friend, Ovoke, O-V-O-K-E, who is suffering from ovarian cancer and cannot afford the money, that is the O2 credits, for the surgery. Now, the narrator, who I don't believe is named, after deciding that law may not be for him and that it needs credits for his own future, and he decides he wants to pay for Avoki's surgery, he decides to enter the games at the O2 Arena, where vast sums of credits can be won if you're willing to fight to the death for them. So that's really it. It's the outcome of the fight to the death, which you know what's going to happen. because the narrator is the one fighting to the death and he's telling the story. So the storyline to me isn't much. And the outcome is very obvious from the beginning. I think the story's appeal lies more in its setting and characters, and you're dealing with science fiction from a country that you haven't read either before or much of at all. And from that perspective, it has a sense of the new, maybe not quite shock of the new, but a sense of the new. I can see this writer has a lot of talent, has a lot going, going to pick up a lot more awards and a lot more attention coming forward. But I just think the whole style needs to improve somewhat. I'd be happy to keep reading this person's work, and I'm not denigrating it for its setting or its locale or what it's doing. I just wasn't really engaged all that much by the story because I thought the plot line was rather obvious. So, you?
Yeah, I would say very much the same sort of thing. Interesting that this one actually won the Nebula in its category, which I found a bit surprising.
Yeah.
I thought it was an interesting enough story, had a good concept, but I just wasn't sure what the takeout was. I mean, is the message that it's at the end of it is that you've got to forget about laws and just go for vigilante justice. It seems to be kind of what he's getting into, that he's studying law at college. Now he's going to become a vigilante fighter, to create justice that way. Now, I wasn't sure whether that was the kind of thing I should really want to take out of it. So, no, I didn't much like it. I'm surprised that it won the Nebula. I haven't read many of the other Nebula nominees in this category. I'm not sure whether I think you have, haven't you?
Perry? I've read some. I haven't read all of them. The Nebula. There's three on this particular category that we've talked about. This O2 Arena, the other one, that story isn't the story by John Wiswell, and the one that you are now about to talk about, Colors of the Immortal Palette, by Catherine M. Joachim, I think. They were on it. There was two others, Just Enough Rain by P.H. Lee, don't know them, and Emmett by Lauren Ring, also another one that I don't particularly know. So it was, yeah, I don't know. So I've read three of the five because they were the three that are also on the Hugo ballot. So,
all right. Well, I'm going to go on to the next one, which I think is the last, is it?
Yep. Yeah, that's it.
So this is Colors of the Immortal Palette by Carolyn M. Joachim, as Perry just mentioned. This is probably going to be my pick for the best of the novelettes this year. I thought it was very well written and full of interest. It's all about art and immortality, being an outsider, being a misfit. So the first-person point of view character is Mari, or properly Mariko. She's Japanese, or at least of Japanese descent, although she's been raised in France. As the story opens, she's working as an artist's model, and she's in the studio of an artist in Paris in the late 1800s. But not just any artist. He is, it seems, immortal, perhaps a kind of vampire. And this fact is no secret, and he is accepted by the other Parisian artists as just one more eccentric member of their group. Ironically, Mariko, as both a woman and an Oriental, is more of an outsider than he is, even though he's this kind of immortal vampire. Mariko, though, isn't merely a model. She, too, wants to become an artist, and she fears that she doesn't have enough time in her life to succeed. The old business of, art is long, life is short. She doesn't think she has enough time in her life to become famous. So she eventually begs the immortal artist, whose name I don't think we ever learn. It's suggested that we would recognize his name as a famous artist if we knew it. She begs him to make her immortal too. And he is able to do this, it seems, but at great cost to himself. So through this process, Mariko does become immortal, and she tries for immortality of renown for her art. And we follow her through several periods of time up to and beyond the modern day. Throughout all this, she finds it difficult to succeed in the male-dominated world of art. Until the latest period, she's better known for the new portrait that the vampire painted of her in the late 1800s, the portrait that she was modelling for at the start of the story. But being immortal is not without cost, of course, as Mariko realises, as her close friends and the artists that she knew in the circle of in Paris all grow old and die one by one, including her closest friend, Victorine, whose loss she takes very hard. I thought there was a lot to this story. I was very impressed by it. It was beautifully written, and it probably will get my vote for best of the stories. What do you think, Perry?
I'd agree. This would be the one that I'm going to be voting for as my pick. I really enjoyed this, and for once I'm going to say I actually wish it was longer.
Mm.
I think this should have been at least at novella length. I would like to get a bit more about Marika's time in America, especially around the time when the Japanese incarcerations were happening during World War II.
Yes.
There's a bit of a mention of it, and you sort of think, well,
it's going to a bit more detail, yeah.
It should go into a bit more detail, because how's she not being picked up? And but I'm being really picky here, David. I did like this story. I thought it was very well written. It flows beautifully. It just gives you a sense of the longing for an artist for recognition and what they will go through to try to get that sense of recognition. Mm. But then when they achieve it, the struggle they then have in accepting what it is they've done to themselves to be able to get to that point. And I did like a slightly changed vampire style. I mean, they basically seem to, this particular vampire seems to live on life force and is able to, the painter being able to almost inject some of their slight life force into their paintings, which make them so radiant and so accepted and so interesting to people.
Hmm.
It's odd. As I said, I don't really go for the idea of saying, well, it's too short, too long. This one, I thought it was too short.
Yeah, and I would agree with that.
I think it needs more. If this particular writer decides to expand this into a... I wouldn't want this as a 600-page novel. No. If he had this as sort of a novella or 250-page novel, I think it would be about right. There's enough here for that to carry to that length, and I think it would be possibly an even better story, though... As you've always got that problem, having people stretch things out, you can get to the point where they put far too much padding in and you think, well, maybe this isn't, maybe they didn't do the right thing. But this one left me wanting more. And if I can't ask much more from a particular story than that. If I would want to carry on either in the world or learn more about those particular characters, I think the author has done everything that they need to for me in this one. So this would be my pick for the novelette. So it's interesting, David, that we both chosen the same novelette. Maybe not necessarily the second and third choices.
We differ on those, but we also agree on the short story too.
On the short stories as well. Yeah. So that's a good thing. Just goes to show you that our I think they stand out. So I think those two. You know, as you said, there's a couple of others that you think might be getting up close.
Mm.
But overall, what did you think? Did you think that were you impressed with the short stories and novelettes? So take the short stories. Do you think it was a good range of
The short stories were disappointing. Really, the only one that's worth looking at is the Pinsker.
Pinkster.
It's hard to say that name, isn't it? The Sarah Pinkster story. That was the only one I thought was you know, deservedly on a Hugo ballot. I thought the others were very ordinary, really.
Yeah.
As a whole. The novelettes, I thought they were all actually pretty good. I don't think any of those really would, shouldn't have been on a ballot.
There was something interesting about all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, as I said, not normally what you get with novelettes, in that I find that they are, as I said earlier on, they're problematic, but these authors seem to have picked things pretty well. There's something there for all of them. Some of them aren't as good as maybe they could have been, but there's something interesting in all of them, which is another reason why people maybe should go and check them out. Sure. But as you also pointed out, that all of these stories are actually available for free, because they were all of them published in all the short stories and all of the other than the one that was published on Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah.
But you can track you can track that down.
Yeah, I've got it. I'll put them all in the show notes. Yeah.
All of them, all of the rest of them were published in the those new electronic e-magazines.
Yeah.
And so they're all out there and all available for people to read. And I'd suggest that people do read them. I mean, Colours of the Immortal Palette, you can read that in a day. In one sitting, you can sit down and you just read it. And I would suggest that you do so, because there are some people here that you're going to have to keep an eye on, because they are the ones that are coming through. Mm. And they are the ones that are going to be the mainstays of the SF and fantasy genres coming up in the years ahead. So why not get a look at them up front and figure out whether you like their style or not? This is the best way of going about doing it.
Sure.
All right, okay. We're done. We're done for the short shorts, the short stories and the novelettes.
Yep.
Next time, next episode, we're going to be dealing with the novellas.
Novellas. There's a fair bit to say about some of those.
Okay. That's good. That's what I like to hear, David. We can have a bit of arguments about a few of them. I've got a good idea.
One I really want to get stuck into. Yeah.
Ooh, okay. I'm looking forward to that. See which one that one is. So that's good. And that'll be great for us to have a bit of a chat about that. But before we go today, we have something else on. I had been told about this particular film, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, by a number of people. And my son went to see it, and I asked him, he's 23, and I asked him, and he said, I don't know whether you're going to like it. What do you mean? He said, well, I'm not sure it's your style, and I'm not going to say anything about it until you go and see it, he said to me. So I thought, right, okay. So I know that my friend W.H. Chong wanted to go and see it, but it, for various reasons we had to see it separately. And I greatly enjoyed it. I really, really enjoyed this film. And Chong wanted to have a bit of a chat about it. So we got together prior to my COVID diagnosis sometime last week. And we did just that, had a bit of a talk. And here is that discussion. So I'm here today with Chong to talk about a new film that we've both watched recently, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, which is a fantastic title. And we're going to have a bit of a chat about what we thought of it and maybe what other people thought about it as well. So I'll start off and I'll just give my brief one sentence or two or three sentence overview of what I thought of it. I thought it was a silly, ridiculous, extremely funny, moving, touching, wonderful film experience, and it was one of the funnest, not funniest, but funnest, let us say, cinema experiences I've had in a very long time. I really, really enjoyed this film. And I would give it a 4.5 out of 5. So a fairly high mark for me, but I really, really enjoyed this. John, what about you?
Wow, I'm so impressed that you liked it so much, Perry. I saw it again recently. And as the title suggests, there's a lot going on in this movie. It's a maximalist movie. And I think the second time round made me realize that one of the ways one can dismiss this film is by thinking because it's so much fun, it doesn't actually reach any deeper places. Well, the second time convinced me that it does everything all at the same time, all at once. So I rate it really highly, and if I were the kind of person who would give stars, I would give it 4.5 stars, maybe even 5 on a good day.
Five on a good day. I wish I'd had a chance to be able to go back and watch it again, because I think it's one of those films that if you like, you will want to go back and watch it again. If you dislike, and I know some people do, and we'll discuss that shortly, that you really wouldn't want to go anywhere near this ever again for the rest of your life. But let's give a bit of a brief overview about what the film is about.
Are we going to spoil, Perry?
We are going to give some spoilers here. So in the end, we will be giving some spoilers, but not just in this first bit, but we will get to spoilers. Anyway, so the main character of the film is a woman by the name of Evelyn, played by Michelle Yeoh, a fine actress who really has not been seen anywhere near enough in Western cinema or on Western cinema screens. She is a wife, mother, and daughter. She's running with her husband a laundromat in, or laundrette, whichever you prefer, in a city in America. Her father has just arrived and is now living with them and is being...
From China.
Is being irascible and difficult and demanding. Her husband, Waymond, he's rather unhappy with the way things are at this time and has drawn up papers for a divorce. It's not that he doesn't love his wife, it's just that he wants her to start paying attention to him and he thinks that this might shock her into doing so. But Evelyn's basically put upon. Everybody wants a piece of her all the time. Her grown-up daughter has come out as being gay and wants Evelyn to introduce her partner to her grandfather, Evelyn's father. But Evelyn's very reticent to do this and just keeps on pushing it off to one side. In addition to all of this, the laundromat hasn't been doing terribly well and they have a few tax problems and at the start of the film are being audited by the IRS. And early on, they have to cart all of their papers, all their tax invoices, receipts, payments, into the tax office where they meet up with a particular taxation officer. And it's at about that point that Evelyn suddenly gets pushed through into a janitor's cupboard where Wayman goes in to find her and he says, I'm actually not your husband. I'm here because I've been looking for an Evelyn all the way through the multiverse to be able to save all the universes from a major threat that is around. And Evelyn's response is, very busy today, no time to help you. And she says it in such a way that I thought, this is going to be a very, very funny film. Up until that point, I was a bit reticent about it. I thought, I didn't know where this was going. I had no idea what it was going to get to. But as soon as she said that and I realised this film is actually going to be very funny, I just decided to sit back and let it run. And yes, it becomes silly, and yes, at times it becomes ridiculous. But it's also a very interesting film with a lot more depth than a lot of people might think on the surface. What's your view?
Wow, you sold me, Perry. I better go and see it a third time. Very busy today. No time to help you.
Well, you can say it with the right accent. I can't do it properly.
Yeah, it's a lot. How does anyone get through their life is one way you could frame the point of this film. And one of the very interesting framing devices is that it's from the mother's point of view. There have been a few recent movies set in a Asian-American kind of family scenario, and it's usually from the point of view of the child, and I guess it has to do with the filmmakers, really. The filmmakers grew up and then decided to do their family. But this, which has been shot by two youngish, I guess, they can't be more than in their 40s, men, both called Daniel, one of whom is, I think, of Chinese ancestry, Daniel Kwan. And they've actually ended up making a film with a mature female matriarchal figure, which seems to me an extraordinary kind of leap for a filmmaker to take.
I had read somewhere that it was they were originally thinking of Jackie Chan for the lead role, but then decided to change it from being a male to a female, and it just changes everything, doesn't
Jackie
it?
Jackie wasn't available.
Okay.
And Michelle had already been asked to do the role of the wife. And then the Daniels realized that, oh, actually, it'd be much better if it was Evelyn who was the main character.
And it is.
And funnily enough, Ki Hoi Chuan, who plays the husband, Wayman, looks like Jackie Chan.
Well, I didn't notice that.
I think so.
Oh, okay. Well, he's an interesting character because he's an actor that has appeared on our screens, but not for some time. He was around for a couple of major films in the 1980s because he played the character of Short Round in one of the Indiana Jones.
Temple of Doom,
yes. Not the best of them. And I think he was also in Goonies later. But after that, he moved into the behind the camera.
He said there were no roles. He asked him to play anything.
Well, that would be right. Yes, and so there was nothing around for him to do, which is, again, why you haven't seen Michelle Yeoh anywhere near as often as we should have seen her in any number of films that could have been made. Any number of Western films that could have been made that she would have been perfect for. Because she's absolutely wonderful in this. She goes from the whole put-upon mother, struggling to keep the family together, struggling to keep the business together, thinking that she's got to do everything and does everything, whether she really does need to or not, but does anyway, to then becoming, well, the sort of saviour of the universes. But it's interesting along the way. She gets, because this is a multiverse, a film about multiverses, namely that every time a small decision is made in this particular universe, another universe branches off from it, and the universe just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's an infinitude of universes that you could be in. And Evelyn actually crosses across a number of the boundaries of these multiverses and is able to see what might have been if she had taken another decision at an earlier age when she was living back in Asia. Does she stay at home? Does she leave? Does she carry on with her studies? Does she do this? Does she do that? And she could have ended up as being a major film actress, Michelle Yeoh, if you like, could have ended up that way. But she's ended up being exactly where she is. And in terms of this particular movie and in terms of Wayman's attempt to find the correct Evelyn, she is the one that he absolutely needs because, as he says, you failed at everything. You're the one that's the... You, Evelyn, in this incarnation, are the one that has failed more often than anybody else at everything that you've done, and that makes you perfect. And so that was also a very amusing and interesting scene where that crops up. But it's got a lot of very, very good homages in this particular film. It points out or pays attention to a number of different films. 2001 was one that struck me quite a lot in this particular instance. There's one particular universe where you may have seen it on the shorts, I think it is. It might be on some of the trailers, where the people in this particular universe look exactly like us, except that they have hot dogs for hands. And there's one lovely little sequence in the film where it harks back to a scene or scenes from 2001 where there are two variants of pre-human apes and two of them are having a major fight. And when the camera pulls back, you find out the one that has died is the one that would have been our precursor, one with the standard fleshy fingers. And the one that has won is the one with the hot dogs for fingers, and that carries all the way right through. And there's some wonderful little things that are used in that particular universe and also others. Now, you saw a number of things in this particular film that I didn't pick up on.
Yeah, one of the very lyrical moments in the film, which is yet another tonal shift in a very crowded kind of space, is when he goes into an homage to Wong Kar-wai, which is the Hong Kong auteur who made, among other things, In the Mood for Love. And there's a passage in here which is an homage to that, where Wayman of another multiverse, when he's kind of very rich and suave, is talking to Michelle Yeoh as Michelle Yeoh, who has become a famous kung fu star. And this is because in that multiverse, they didn't run away and get married and start a laundromat in America. So that was one of the things in which they had a moment in which they reflected on how life might have been like if they had not tried to become a married couple and find happiness in that sort of way. Did you have any problems, Perry, relating to this because it's a Chinese family drama apart from anything else?
No.
Because some critics do have this issue with non-Western characters.
Which I don't understand. I really don't.
So I'll give you an example. Earlier this year, Pixar put out, this is on Disney Plus, an animation called Turning Red, which has been very well received and, as far as I understand it, very successful finding an audience. But when it first came out in March, this is one of the first reviews it got from a place called Cinema Blend and a critic, Sean O'Connell, who said that he felt that Turning Red was very specifically designed for the Asian community of Toronto. And if you were one of the directors, Tommy Shi's friends and immediate family members, it would be fine. But that he felt the target audience was very specific and very narrow. And if you're in it, it would work very well for you. But I am not in it. And he said this was exhausting. So this review has well and truly been retracted and caused a huge controversy for very good reasons. But before I remark on that too, it'd be worth connecting it directly to a review in The New Yorker by Richard Brody of Everything Everywhere All at Once. Here's the last two sentences of his review. He writes, "The protagonist," which would be Evelyn and Wayman and Joy, the daughter, and the rest of them, "the protagonists are universalized, stripped of history and culture, lacking any personal connection to the wider world. With its bland and faux universal life lessons that cheaply ethicalize expensive sensationalism, the film comes off as a sickly, cynical feature. Sickly, cynical feature-length directorial pitch reel for a Marvel movie." So there's a bunch of stuff going on in there. One is that clearly these two, shall I say, white male critics found it impossible to relate to this film and therefore found no interest in it. They clearly couldn't even laugh at the jokes in it. And also, of course, there's that strong smell of some kind of a dominant patriarchal white culture view that if it's not set in our world, then it doesn't matter. So it's an odd criticism that Richard Brody makes, because or Sean O'Connell previously, because, you know, it's like if you don't live in the world of James Bond, you can't relate to the film. If you don't live in the world of Regency England, you can't relate to Jane Austen. You know, if you can't, if you don't live in the world of India, you can't relate to Apu, the Apu films, or any idea that fiction is about to, is supposed to help you expand and to find interest in other people. That is the universalizing aspect of fiction itself.
And I don't understand that at all. I really don't. The family drama that's at the heart of this particular spectacular science fiction film is universal. It's the same that you get everywhere. I mean, we had a discussion earlier on today before we came on to do this recording, and I was talking about one relative of mine who was rather similar to the grandfather in this, in that he's always demanding and never saying anything of never saying anything positive to anybody. There are a number of examples of people with in exactly the same problem, with either a non-binary child or a child that is gay, and the difficulty or not that the parents have in either coming to terms with that situation or helping other members of the family come to terms with that. I think that's also universal. I don't see why the colour of the skin or the names that people have changes any of this at all. And I think that these two particular reviews that you have quoted from just show a lack of understanding about what's going on. It's almost with Brody's here where he's talking about this being a feature-length directorial pitch reel for a Marvel movie, that the only thing that matters are Marvel movies if they're going to be about this. I mean, this is completely different to the approach that was taken in the Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. It's completely different. Well, why can't it be different? Why can't you have a different perspective of things? You don't have to have everything that has got to be come out of a toothpaste tube and look exactly the same. I don't want that. I don't want that at all. I want something that is going to, well, like this. It's going to make me laugh. It's going to make me cry. It's going to be...
But isn't one of the weird things about this Brody review, and I think it's worth harping on a bit, is that in a Marvel movie, the particular history and culture of a Marvel movie is very hermetic. And, you know, famously, you know, you're supposed to watch all 22 or 28 or however many they are now chapters of Marvel to understand what's going on in the MCU. And in this review of Everything Everywhere All at Once, Brody writes, the protagonists are stripped of history and culture, which seems to me completely the opposite thing. They are entirely embedded in the history and culture. So one of the Daniels in an interview says, we started getting self-conscious about some of the Asian American tropes in the film, but at the same time, so many of them were just true. Dan would be like, this is just what my granddad's laundromat looked like. So we started embracing them. And when I was watching the movie, I was thinking, there's so much kind of like Asianness about this film, and in a seemingly, to me anyway, very accurate representation of Asian house decor, the way, you know, migrants so often live above their businesses, the way Asian families don't get touchy and feely with each other, the way in the entire film, even though what it tracks down to is trying to find a better relationship within the family, nobody ever says, I love you, which is a very Asian absence of emotional articulation. God, that's so badly put, emotional articulation.
Yeah, but what it comes to me is I think some of these critics are basically trying to come out and sort of say, well, the audience that they're pitched at is too small, or that the scenarios they're coming up with are cliched. Well, they're not cliched because we haven't seen them. Cliches, to me, always start off with a basis of truth, that regardless of whatever it is, that the first time that something is said, it can't be a cliche by definition, but it may well be true. The more times you say it, then it becomes, well, that's, you know, take the football parlance, we're taking it one game at a time. But that's perfectly true. That's exactly what you do. If you get ahead of yourself, you're going to be in trouble. There's no cliche involved in this, because this is one of the first times we've ever seen anything like this on a Western screen with this amount of production value sitting behind it. You just don't get this sort of stuff. And that's why I think it becomes interesting, even if just for that. Now, there are going to be some people that are not going to get past that first 10 or 15 minutes where it just looks like, oh, God, this is just an Asian drama of, you know, somebody in a business not going to be doing terribly well. How are they going to integrate everything? And then it just explodes and just goes all over the place. And I think it was wonderful. You have to basically go with the flow with this particular film, let it wash over the top of you, which is why I think your idea of going back and seeing it a second time is an excellent one, because it allows you then to bring all that those bits together and you can say, right, okay, I like this bit. I didn't necessarily like this other part. Maybe the start's a bit too slow. Maybe some of these other parts are ridiculous. Well, yeah, they are. But the second time around, I think it's basically going to wash over you and you're going to go, yeah, this is
do you
good
think,
stuff.
Do you think it was the first time there was a epic kung fu action scene set in an IRS office?
I think so. I think there probably was. And especially with sex toys coming into it as well.
Which oh, my God, there were so many sex toys.
They were just all over the place, but they were just... You could see them. You knew what was going to happen. As soon as I saw one of the butt plugs sitting back there, or one of the rewards, I thought, God, that looks just like a butt plug. I mean, what the heck are they doing?
Earlier film, Swiss Army Man, there was quite a running joke with stuffing things up the anus as well.
Oh, okay.
So they're really into this.
A bit of anal humour.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with a bit of anal humour here and there. But this was just funny. And you could see something, you sort of thought something was going to happen. And when it did, I just about cacked myself. I thought it was just so funny. And they did it so well, I thought, you know, and with the idea that there's this guy with his big butt plug sticking out of his backside and it's all fuzzed out so you can't see it all. So it's just
it's
wonderful.
One of the things I realise now, that all the kung fu sequences, which are incredibly fun and great to watch, they're all played for laughs.
Yeah.
Every single one of them.
Yeah.
And some of the jokey sequences, which includes two rocks on a dead planet, are played for tears. They do a lot of very inventive, subversive things with their setups.
There is a heck of a lot to like in this particular film. I'd recommend it to anybody to go along and have a look at it, but I'm fully aware, and some friends of mine have already told me that they hated it. Could not stand it.
Can you say what they hated?
They just thought it was... it just didn't go anywhere. It didn't make any sense. It was ridiculous.
Was part of it because they couldn't relate to the characters?
No, they didn't say that. They just thought that the whole plot and the drama didn't make any sense.
So does Doctor Strange and the Madness...
The multiverse of madness.
Does that make sense?
It does if you have watched all of the previous Marvel Cinematic Universe, but you, with that one in particular, you have to have watched the...
Because you saw it, didn't you?
I did. And
does
I,
it make as much sense as Everything Everywhere All at Once, or do they make equal sense?
They make equal sense, but Everywhere All at Once you can just go into on its own because it is a standalone film. Whereas the Doctor Strange film, you must have watched the WandaVision, which is a 10-episode Disney Plus Marvel Studios television series, prior to going in, because otherwise you don't understand.
So
the...
would your friends have had the same problems with watching Doctor Strange?
I don't know, because I don't think they like the Marvel stuff. They haven't kept up with it, so they may well have had if they'd gone into that cold without having watched anything else, they would not have understood what the what some of the major protagonists, why they were doing the things the way they were doing them, and what was driving them on. And you needed to, with Doctor Strange, have seen WandaVision to be able to determine that. So,
what is the difference between the use of the multiverse frame in Doctor Strange and in Everything Everywhere All at Once?
There's not a lot. I mean, basically it comes down to the idea that there are these separate universes that live side by side, and that it is possible in various ways to be able to travel between one and another.
But there is a moral to the use of it in Everything Everywhere All at Once. Is there a similar meaning, a central core meaning in Doctor Strange?
So, you know, I don't really think so.
In Everything Everywhere All at Once is that, you know, you could have had, as we always think, no, I could have had a different life if I'd done A, B, C, D, E.
Yep.
But maybe what you need to do is just settle, as it were.
Right.
And just
accept what you've got here, because this is where you've ended up.
Yeah.
Whereas in Doctor Strange, they're using knowledge from the other multiverses in order to be able to repair or make their own better. So what they're saying is that things have drifted over from one to another and made things worse, and therefore they have to be repaired. So,
right. So kind of more instrumental, more transactional.
If you want to put it that way, that sounds like a good way of putting it, yes.
So not very zen, really.
No, not at all. I mean, it's spectacularly good in terms of the way they do things, where they break through from one universe into another, and one of them, as they're floating across the screen, sort of... Again, there's always this idea that you break through glass to get through something. That's a similar thing, because there's a bit of glass fracturing in Everything Everywhere, and also in the Doctor Strange. And as they go through, they break through one barrier into another, and one of them they turn into paint. Just paint going across with the same colours, and then they burst through that universe and go out the other side and become whole again.
The multiverse iterations in Everything Everywhere All at Once is they become animated.
Mm.
And another one, they become piñata figures. So there is that kind of playful invention here too. But I think their budgets are quite different.
Oh, I would have thought so. Yes, I would have thought that the Doctor Strange budget was in the hundreds of millions, and this one would have been...
24.
Well, there you are. Well, let me just say then that that's a very, very inventive and inspirational use of $24 million to be able to produce a very interesting multiverse film, as they've done with Everything Everywhere All at Once. And there would have been hundreds of millions on Doctor Strange, I would have thought.
Question, Perry, did you cry?
I always cry. I always cry. Anytime there's anything emotional, I've got to that stage of my life where tears roll down the face. So... I really did like this particular film, and I am absolutely certain that I will go back and see it again. Whether I see it on the big screen, which I'd like to be able to do, but movies are moving through very quickly at the moment.
Oh, yes.
They're not hanging around for terribly long. This one's, except for the big, you know, the big blockbusters like the Marvel stuff, so Doctor Strange is... I mean, they're showing it. The cinema that I went to see it in during the day, there were three of us in the cinema, and there were like 10 or 12 sessions in the day. I mean, they're just backing them up on multiple screens and putting them in, and there's just not the number of people around to watch it. I mean, for a long period of time, I thought I was going to be the only person in the cinema, but two other people turned up and sat two or three rows back, and it was quite a large cinema, and you sort of think, doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. They're the ones that do big blockbuster business because everybody thinks they're going to.
The madness of the multiplex.
Well, that's right. And this one, I think, is going to be a quiet sleeper. Let me tell you, I've already got it pegged as being one of the films that I'll be nominating for a Hugo Award for next year. I would nominate it rather than Doctor Strange, because I thought Doctor Strange was... I have my own feeling about that particular film. I think it's more transitional rather than being...
No doubt Doctor Strange will be nominated.
Probably will be.
And but given the kind of membership, I think they probably find an Asian family drama with the trappings of multiverse probably less to their taste.
Ah, don't forget, though, next year's World Science Fiction Convention is being held in China. I would think...
It's very funny.
I think that Everything Everywhere All at Once might just have picked the exact year to come out in terms of the Hugo Awards. I think there might be a really good chance that it will pick up an award next year. And I would be very happy to see that happen. I think we'll finish it there. Sound good?
Yeah.
Thanks very much. But thanks for the chat. I will definitely be going back and seeing it again.
Thank you, Perry.
Thanks very much to Chong for coming along and having a bit of a chat about that. I hope that was interesting. But I think that's about it for our episode this time, David.
Indeed.
As I said earlier on, we're going to be dealing with the novellas next, the Hugo finalist novellas for next episode. And after that, we'll look at the novels.
Indeed. All right, so we'll be back, because we've been a bit delayed this week, we'll be back in 2.5 weeks. So I think that means we'll be out on the 28th of June by my calculation. I think that's right.
2 weeks Tuesday-ish. So 2.5 weeks away we'll be back.
Yeah,
and then we'll get back on the schedule again.
Yep, sure.
All right.
Okay, cool.
Thanks, David.
Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Talk to you next time.